The final part of our audio extra program is the rest of an interview with Dr. Andrew Zhu, and in our supplemental conversation, we chatted about biliary cancer. Dr. Zhu began by putting the disease in perspective.
I think, Dr. Laffey, biliary cancer, in my opinion, is actually the next challenge for oncology. In particular, for us doing GI oncology, I think it's really represent a major challenge. When I say this is a major challenge, this is really manifested in several aspects. The disease is very heterogeneous. We have the gallbladder cancer, the extrahepatic bile duct cancer, and also the intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma. So clinically, even though they all share some similarities, but we know that they actually probably distinct disease. And biologically, I think, you know, we're starting to appreciate that they may be also very heterogeneous in terms of the mechanism for pathogenesis. This is actually a group of very rare type of cancers. So as a community, we have not really put together the concerted efforts trying to design some state-of-the-art clinical trials so that these information can guide us to design the next generation clinical trial and also to give us the state-of-the-art practice guideline, if you will. And over the past year, I think there are a few areas that we probably should actually spend a few minutes to discuss a little bit. The major breakthrough, in my opinion, in this disease is for the first time, led by the British investigators, for the first time, they're actually able to conduct a national randomized phase 3 study asking a very simple question, because in the field of biliary tract cancer, we know there are a few chemotherapeutic agents that actually have demonstrated single agent activity or even activity based on the phase 2, small phase 2 clinical trials. The British investigators actually really took this information and really asked a very simple, but on the other hand, very important question. Is combination chemotherapy, i.e. when you combine gemcitabine with a platinum-based compound, in this case cisplatin, versus just gemcitabine alone, whether you're actually improving the outcome in this population? So as you recall, you know, this study was a positive study in terms of improving the overall survival from 8.3 to 11.7 months. And this was highly statistically significant. They also demonstrated by going with a combination regimen, you can improve the progression-free survival also by approximately 2 months. So with this positive data, for the first time, we actually have a new standard how to treat patients with unresectable biliary tract cancers. And for the first time, we actually demonstrated if we put serious efforts, we can actually answer these questions logically using the clinical trial mechanism so that we can really answer one question after another systemically. I think this is really a very important step in the field of bile duct cancer, just because I think a lot of us in the field always feel like it is an important disease. But so what? The big pharma's not interested in this disease. They're very hesitant to put their drugs into the clinical trials. I don't think the government has put enough funding in this area. And also as an individual investigator, you know, when you study a rare type of tumor like bile duct cancer, it is so hard to be productive because it takes years to finish a study. But I think with this positive study, it really gives us new momentum. With this, we have more questions that we can address in the community. This is really the best combination that we can come up with. Can we build up biologic agents on this platform? Whether this is the only acceptable combination that we can use down the road? Whether we can use this regimen in the new adjuvant setting to convert some patients from unresectable setting or borderline resectable setting to resectable setting? So all these questions all of a sudden become real. We feel like we have the platform to answer these questions. I think from the surgical perspective, I think our surgical colleagues continue to define the surgical techniques, how to select patients to really perform successful resection, which, as you know, remains to be the only definitive treatment for this disease. I think, you know, our surgical colleagues continue to refine the surgical techniques and how to really prognostic these patients so that we can actually offer the right patient with the right surgical techniques.
Now, how often is the diagnosis made pre-op so the surgeon going in knows what's going on?
So this is a very fair question. I think that also varies from specific subtype to the specific tumor types that you're talking about. As you know, I'll give you an example. For gallbladder cancer, there are a lot of patients who came in with cholelithiasis picture, cholecystitis picture, and the clinicians usually think that the patient just have a gallstone, but when they remove the gallbladder, they actually in turn find out that you have the incidental gallbladder cancer on the resective specimen. I think, you know, the question that we were discussing is how many times the surgeon actually have the preoperative diagnosis of specific tumor type. I think the answer that I was actually giving is that it really depends on the specific tumor type as well. Now, for gallbladder cancer, as you know, it is actually very hard unless you have the high clinical suspicion. We have a lot of cases, patient presents with acute right abdominal pain, ultrasound showed an inflamed gallbladder, sometimes there are some gallstones present. A lot of surgeons in the community will say, look, this may be just the acute cholecystitis. So they went ahead, resected the gallbladder, and incidentally, by the pathologist, they noticed that we actually have gallbladder carcinoma in the resected gallbladder specimen. So I think a high clinical suspicion in the gallbladder setting is very important to make the right diagnosis. Now, in the intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, on the other hand, usually you actually have some imaging suspicion already. Usually the presentation can be an incidental finding on CT scan or MRI scan for other purposes. All of a sudden, we identify a large mass in the liver. The surgeon already really have reasonable suspicion. Usually, they even also have the preoperative diagnosis by the biopsy. So they are actually pretty prepared what kind of diagnosis it is and what kind of surgery they should actually perform. And so in that setting, I think the planning usually is actually more adequate. For extrahepatic bile duct cancer, sometimes the diagnosis is also very challenging. Sometimes they can present with just biliary obstruction, with jaundice, but without radiographic evidence of mass lesion. And also when the endoscopists perform the ERCP, and they can perform the cytology analysis, but sometimes the cytology turned out to be negative in most cases. So you couldn't actually establish the definitive diagnosis before you actually go in with the operation. But I think the key thing is if the clinicians actually have very high suspicion for these entities, in general, they will actually come up with better information. And also, most likely, that will actually lead them to the right diagnosis and also to help them to plan the necessary operation.
Is there much of an issue of an appropriate operation? Do most general surgeons know what to do? Or in a tertiary center, do people get surgery that's more effective?
Yeah, this is a very, very relevant question in all the surgical oncology field right now. I think the consensus right now seems to be for all these sophisticated operations, what I mean by that is really a liver resection, a Whipple procedure for distal bile duct cancer, or a very definitive gallbladder resection, maybe with some lymphadenectomy dissection as well as maybe part of the liver resection. All these techniques we come to appreciate, I think the outcome tends to be better if it's actually done by an experienced surgeon of high volume and also if it's done in a tertiary center with a very high surgical volume. I think this seems to be true for few tumor types. In particular, I think for liver resection, for gallbladder cancer. And this really requires the surgeons having specific expertise in these areas.
One more thing is I want to focus mainly on HCC, but you had a paper presented at last year's ASCO, and I see it just got published in Lancet Oncology, looking at GEM, OXALI, and BEV in biliary tract cancers, and specifically also the issue of using PET scanning to evaluate that. Can you kind of go through that work?
We started this study quite a few years ago. You know, the rationale for this particular study design was based on the fact that we know from several phase 2 studies that GemOx, gemcitabine in combination with oxaliplatin, seems to be a pretty reasonable regimen, both in terms of tolerability as well as in terms of inducing radiographic responses. I think consistently from several phase 2 studies, the response rate has consistently been somewhere between 30 to 50% across all studies. And also, as you know, the GemOx regimen was actually developed from our colleagues dealing with pancreatic cancer. So we have this regimen for quite a while with the notion that VEGF is definitely a player in bile duct cancer and higher VEGF expression seems to predict poor outcome. We thought it would be very reasonable to assess whether we can combine bevacizumab, in this case, the antibody against VEGF, and with GemOx, see whether we can actually even augment the efficacy that we observe from GemOx alone. So that's why we designed the study giving all three drugs every 2 weeks. The regimen is incredibly easy because even though, as you probably know, there is a rationale, theoretical rationale, giving Gem and oxaliplatin on two different consecutive days. But when we designed the study, we were actually taking a very practical approach. The folks in Boston coming to the city is actually pretty hard for them. We have a lot of patients commuting from New Hampshire, Vermont, to get to Boston to get treatment. So we designed the study actually giving all three drugs in 1 day. And so the treatment is really once every 2 weeks until disease progression, as well as if they develop intolerable toxicity. And I think when we first designed the study, due to logistics reason, we can't design a randomized phase 2 study, which will be the preferred study design. It would be nice to see whether you can do a randomized phase 2 looking at GemOx versus GemOx plus bevacizumab, because that will give us a little bit better information, both in terms of the tolerability and also, more importantly, the relative contribution of bevacizumab. By doing a BioDoc study, I think all the sponsors will question whether you have enough accrual, whether the study will drag you forever. So for logistic reasons, we were settling down with single-arm study using all three drugs in all the patients treated. So we just reported in the Lancet Oncology, of the 35 patients that we treated, clearly we observed 40% response rate. These were actually true response. These are the patients who came in with huge tumor burden with the treatment. You can definitely appreciate the radiographic shrinkage per RECIST criteria. And also our PFS was 7 months. Overall survival was also very respectful, exceeding 11 months range. But on the other hand, just because this is a single-arm study, our study would not be able to answer the question definitively whether the bevacizumab actually contributed anything to our regimen. I think in our hands, we feel like this regimen is an active regimen. But just because of the single-arm nature, we couldn't actually answer this question definitively. But the tolerability was very, very acceptable. We encounter very few grade 3 and 4 events. In particular, in contrast to other experience that we have with bevacizumab in other type of tumors, the bevacizumab-related toxicity, i.e. thromboembolic events, bleeding, very refractory hypertension, was actually encountered at low frequency. Yeah.
What about the FDG PET issues or the aspect of the study?
When we first designed this study, we were curious because as a clinician, the typical routine that we're doing in the clinic is really you throw the regimen to the patients, you keep doing it as long as they can tolerate, and then you bring them back, say, in 2 months and look at the CT scan and see how they're doing by radiographic evaluation. I think the challenge for all of us is really whether we can actually identify early both imaging or biological markers so that will actually help us to make treatment decision earlier. If we know the patient is actually moving in the wrong direction, you don't necessarily need to push these patients with these chemotherapy regimen too long. You can actually probably make a treatment decision earlier. And that was essentially the rationale why we actually incorporate the PET assessment. Due to the budget issue, we couldn't actually really assess multiple time points of the PET scan after the treatment, because that will actually give us more information regarding the kinetic changes of the FDG avid disease change. We may be able to pick up even an earlier time point, but I think just because we can only do a baseline PET and also one time point following the treatment, so we arbitrarily just select one time point post-treatment. But what we have found out is that if you actually have the PET change, i.e. that those patients who have decreased FDG uptake in their tumor after the treatment, this is definitely correlated with their PFS and also with their long-term overall survival. Obviously, this is a hypothesis-generating small study. I think it really, really enforced the notion that we may actually need to explore this particular imaging down the road, maybe even looking at the FDG PET changes, maybe in earlier time points. Maybe this can actually help us to make treatment decision down the road as a very useful marker, yeah.
What about this regimen outside a protocol setting? Do you think it's a rational consideration at this point? GemOx, Bev, what you reported here in the phase 2 study, do you think that that's a rational off-protocol consideration in practice?
I don't think so, Dr. Love. This is the study that my colleagues and I conducted. We were very, very encouraged by the initial results. But I think we should refrain ourselves from using this one routinely in our practice. I do think that the more logical question to ask is really trying to establish if adding bevacizumab to a combination chemotherapy like GemOx would definitely have the added value. The way to do that, in my opinion, is really in the randomized study design setting so that you will have a control arm and also the other arm will be the tested arm with the addition of bevacizumab. I think only if we have some more definitive data showing that adding bevacizumab in this setting clearly is doing something both in terms of the efficacy and also importantly, the safety profile continue to hold true. I think we should refrain ourselves from using the GemOx bevacizumab in our clinical practice routinely.
You've published some work looking at the hepatic effects of systemic therapy in patients who have hepatic-only metastatic disease. A very common question that we see in docs in practice, how long can they give drugs before the patient can go to surgery? Which drugs have what kind of effects on the liver? Can you kind of summarize what we know about that issue?
This is obviously a rapidly evolving field. We are very excited that with the current combination chemotherapy and in combination with biologics, we can achieve significant radiographic response. As a result, the last decade has really witnessed a significant advancement in patients with metastatic colorectal cancer to the liver. I think in general, we're considering three categories in this particular setting. The first category, obviously, is that the surgeon can actually clearly remove the liver mass upfront. They do not necessarily need the help from the systemic therapy. So the question in that setting is whether doing the chemotherapy, either preoperatively or post-op, will actually have added benefit. The second category is the patient presents with borderline resectable disease. These are the patients with significant tumor burden in the liver. Some of them are actually encroaching the major vessels, making the surgical resection somewhat challenging. In that setting, when we introduce the new adjuvant chemotherapy, we can actually induce significant radiographic response. And the surgeon can clearly convert some of these cases from the borderline resectability to resectable disease very easily. The last category is when patient presents with absolutely unresectable disease, meaning that you know that based on the extent of the tumor, the surgeon will not be able to resect these tumors based on the conventional wisdom. So in this case, we're actually getting to the point that we can actually convert some of these patients from the true unresectable setting to the resectable setting. However, as we're using these chemotherapy more common and also for longer period of time, now we started to appreciate that all these active chemotherapies, they do actually carry a certain type of hepatic toxicity. I think this field is still slowly evolving. We wish we had more data at this point. I don't think right now we have actually definitive data, but suffice to say that we know each particular chemotherapeutic agent has a particular pattern of hepatic toxicity. For example, all the drugs probably can cause steatohepatitis, even though the degree as well as the frequency remains to be defined. We know oxaliplatin can cause what we call sinusoidal obstruction. So if you actually don't pay attention that the oxaliplatin can actually cause sinusoidal obstruction, which can actually lead to portal hypertension with thrombocytopenia. I think the combination of biologic, in particular bevacizumab, in conjunction with other chemotherapy, I think the data is still not as complete as we'd like. I think there's some data showing that combining bevacizumab with conventional chemotherapy may even have protective benefit. For example, if you combine with FOLFOX, maybe the sinusoidal obstruction can be alleviated with the addition of bevacizumab, but I don't think the data is very, very definitive. I think the bleeding risk associated with bevacizumab has also been addressed. I think the conventional wisdom is that you absolutely have to stop the bevacizumab at least 4 to 6 weeks if you're planning the hepatic resection. And you can only resume the treatment probably 4 to 6 weeks at least after the operation. But I think there are some cases that if patients have to go to emergency surgery, I think the safety profile appears to be okay. We don't have a lot of long-term data in terms of how bevacizumab affect the ability of hepatic regeneration. As you know, when the liver is actually undergoing resection, it really induces the hypertrophy in the unresected area. So whether the addition of this biologic will have some long-term toxicity to impair the ability of the liver to regenerate, I don't think the data is actually that complete at this point. The data of combining cetuximab with the conventional chemotherapy, I think the data is very limited right now. We actually don't have any specific toxicity that we can actually attribute to cetuximab when it's combined with the conventional chemotherapy. But as we're using the cetuximab or panitumumab in combination with chemotherapy based on the KRAS data more often upfront, I think that's an area that I think we should keep an eye on. In terms of the duration of the treatment, if the goal is really trying to shrink the tumor for the surgeon to be able to resect the tumor, I think once that goal is achieved, you should actually proceed with the surgical resection right there. So in other words, in this field, you should not aim to achieve maximal response, but rather to achieve the response the surgeon will be able to accomplish a definitive R0 resection. I think that's pretty much the consensus in the field at this point.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for this special Web Extra edition to GI Cancer Update.